dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a great privilege that we can frequently take the counsel and benefit from the insights of the career intelligence professional who now heads the Center for Security Policy, our president and CEO, Fred Flights. Fred, of course, has worked for the Central Intelligence Agency for the better part of two decades. He has been a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee and has served under Ambassador John Bolton, first at the State Department and then at the Trump National Security Council. We're very grateful to him for joining us, especially because of his well-established expertise in matters having to do with North Korea and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in which it's long been engaged. Fred Flights, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Good to be here, Frank.
Well, there's some news about North Korea. They apparently tested some sort of tactical weapon yesterday. It's not entirely clear what they mean by that, but it does suggest that they're getting back into the business of testing things. What did you make of this, Fred, and what insights, if any, do we have as to what they're up to at the moment?
Well, North Korea claims it tested what it's calling a new tactical guided weapon. I read some experts in the press saying that this doesn't violate North Korea's decision not to test ballistic missiles. I don't think we know that right now. I think we can be sure that this is an act of defiance, and it's worrisome. Now, there have been more press reports that think tanks are saying that imagery indicates that North Korea is stepping up its preparations to test missiles at its missile sites. You know, we've talked about this before. I'm skeptical about that because it's very difficult to interpret these satellite images because North Korea knows we're watching. But we're in a difficult stage right now to try to get talks of North Korea back on track. And I think whether this was a violation of the agreement or not, I think it was certainly part of their efforts to pressure the United States to come to the negotiating table and to make more concessions than the president is prepared to make. Frank, I also want to note that the North Koreans have called for Mike Pompeo to be removed as the chief negotiator on the North Korea nuclear talks. This is a good sign. It means that Pompeo is being tough.
It does, and I hope that there will be no thought given to removing him from that role, as he's seemingly doing a pretty good job of representing the president's views on the subject.
I absolutely agree.
Fred, I want to take advantage of the fact that you're also one of the country's preeminent experts on Iran to ask you to reflect briefly on the upcoming first anniversary of President Trump's courageous and, I think, necessary decision to withdraw from the, well, you've called it, I've called it the Obama bomb deal, the Iran nuclear deal that Barack Obama signed off on. Tell us what has happened in this intervening period and where we are at the moment with respect to Iran.
Well, on the 8th of May, it will be the first anniversary of President Trump's decision to withdraw from the nuclear deal with Iran. You may remember all the hand-wringing and condemnations that this is going to result in a war and it would never work. It's worked quite well. European states said that they wouldn't cooperate, but their companies are cooperating, because European companies have decided that it is much better to do business with the United States than with Iran. And I'll tell you, one of the best stories I've seen in a long time surface today, the New York Times is no longer sending its reporters to Iran because it's too dangerous. So what businessman is going to risk the lives of his employees to do business with the corrupt and backward Iranian regime when they could do business with the United States? That's just not a decision here. What we're doing is we're not only making it clear that Iran's nuclear program is not legitimate and nations shouldn't sell equipment to Iran to help with it. We're cutting off funds that's propping up the mullahs. I think a revolution is coming in Iran one day, and this corrupt nuclear deal was putting the date off of that revolution. So, I mean, this was just a great decision. I can see more benefits from it coming down the road.
Yeah. Well, I pray that they will, and that day of the revolution is sooner rather than later. Fred, very quickly, you have been writing and warning about the behavior of a representative by the name of Ilhan Omar for some time now. It appears that she becomes even more aggressive in promoting sort of, well, what I call a Sharia supremacist line, but certainly in association with organizations like the Council on American Islamic Relations. Her posture is becoming, according to even the New York Times, more challenging for Democrats to defend. How is it they defend her at all, Fred?
You know, I really have trouble explaining that, but Brett Stephen had a great op-ed in today's New York Times, Ilhan Omar, harbinger of democratic decline. And he says that with political power comes rhetorical responsibility. When she referred to the 9/11 attacks as some people did something, and she's downplaying the significance of this horrific act of terrorism by jihadists against the United States. Even for Stevens, so I think he used to be a conservative, he's now a liberal, this just went too far. And I really think that Ilhan's supporters of the Democratic Party are fighting a losing battle. I don't think the American people are with them on this. They don't want to see liberals or conservatives downplaying massive terrorist attacks against the United States as some people did something. I think Omar and her allies are trying to take over the Democratic Party. And my hope is that the Democrat leaders are going to start stepping up and fighting back.
Yeah, they have to. I mean, really, this is about more than just the Democratic Party's future character. It's about the country. And, you know, one of the other things, Fred, I just want to make note of is that it got a lot less attention than that rather offensive way of describing the 9/11 attacks. But she also described the Council on American Islamic Relations, for whom she was raising money at the time, as a civil rights organization that was founded after 9/11 to protect Muslims whose rights were being infringed upon. There's so much wrong with that sentence that it's hard to parse it, especially in the shortness of time we have. But I did want to just mention, as you know, Fred, one of the things that's wrong about that is that the federal government has proven in federal court that CARE was actually founded in 1993, formally started in 1994 by a terrorist organization known as Hamas. And it was not for civil rights purposes. It was for political warfare and fundraising for that terrorist organization. So let the record show, and let us ask Ilhan Omar what she's doing hanging around with such people. Fred, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate your time as well as your leadership at the Center for Security Policy. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we will speak with Rick Manning about the Mueller report and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a delight to say, joined by one of my favorite people. I mean, truly one of the most, well, interesting and effective minds in Washington, D.C. His name is Richard Manning. He is the president of a terrific organization, Americans for Limited Government. He is a featured host, in fact, not just a guest, at Breitbart Radio. He is also much in demand on other outlets, in part because of his acumen about what is going on inside the swamp. He has, among other things, been up close and personal with the swamp in connection with work he did as the chief for public relations of the Department of Labor under George W. Bush. And it is a great, great privilege to have him with us. Rick Manning, thank you for finding a few minutes for us on what I know is a very busy day.
Hey, Frank, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity. And, you know, I love coming on with you simply because the introduction is so it's so overwhelming that I it's really almost don't recognize myself. So thanks a lot.
I know you'll live up to it. Listen, part of the reason why it's such a busy day is that William Barr is releasing the Mueller report to Congress. That hasn't happened as we speak. By the time this program airs, it will have, of course. But I'd like you to talk about what is going on with respect to the Mueller report as things stand at the moment, particularly the histrionics about what Bill Barr has been doing with respect to producing a summary of this report several weeks ago with respect to the redactions from this report and with respect to the fact that he's even having the temerity to have a press conference about it and in the process of releasing the document. What are we to make of all of this thrashing going on, Rick Manning?
Well, I know one thing. If the Democrats were happy with the results of the Mueller report, they would certainly not be beating up Bill Barr related to it. What the Democrats want to be able to do, and the anti-Trump people, I'm going to not just say Democrats, the anti-Trump people want to be able to do, is they want to be able to interpret the Mueller report for people, since it's about 400 pages. So they want to do the interpretation. They want to tell people what's in it. And by Attorney General Barr coming forward and saying, I'm going to tell you what's in it. I'm going to tell you why things got redacted. They got redacted, assuming there are redactions within it. I'm basically going to give you the rationale for the release and the rationale for any decision we made related to that release and any future action we're going to take. This is a reasonable thing for the Attorney General to do, but the reason the left is thrashing around about it is they're accustomed to being able to interpret things for their viewers and not interpret them in a positive way. Barr is going to give a neutral, even-handed approach to it. This is what it says. This is what we're doing, and here's why. And essentially, they're going to be arguing with Barr about whether he made the right decision, but they're not going to be able to argue about what's in the report.
Right. One of the other things that they're very unhappy with him about at the moment, of course, is his assertion that there was spying going on. There was, I would argue, actually collusion, not only spying, but collusion with the Russians that enabled that spying to take place. But it was on the part of Hillary Clinton and her campaign and her friends in the deep state inside the Obama administration. The need for such an investigation seems manifest to me. How do you see it, Rick?
Oh, absolutely. It's a, 2 years ago, I was of the mind that it would have been bad form to go and really prosecute a failed presidential candidate, even if that person had done pretty egregious things, which I think the Clintons have, Hillary in particular. But 2 years have gone by, and we've seen a fake prosecution, a whole kind of false flag operation that's been run against this president, an attempted coup. And you know, the world, that's changed everything. We have a situation where we cannot allow for this to have occurred without there being anybody who broke the law, without them being held accountable for the full extent of the law. And quite honestly, if the Clinton campaign, if the Clinton team was intimately involved in this, if Obama was intimately involved in this, we need a full accounting. We need a full historical accounting. We need, at the very least, destroy their reputations forever so no politician tries this again.
Well, of course, it would be they who would destroy their reputations when they are held accountable. And that's really the key point.
Well, you know, but remember, Obama's reputation in his own mind is that he's a scandal-free administration. When they had the most egregious scandals in, I think, the history of our country within their administration. And the reason it was so-called scandal-free was because they were so in bed with the Fourth Estate that there was no one to report the scandal.
Yeah, let alone anyone to prosecute the scandals. Eric Holder, who by
contrast with Bill Barr, I think, does not look very good, needless to say, as an attorney general. One of the other things that Bill Barr did this week, and Rick, you cover so many different fronts at Americans for Limited Government, but I did want to ask you about his decision on refusing bail for illegal aliens coming through parts of our southern border other than the ports of entry to seek asylum. What are the implications of that, and is he well within his rights to make such a decision, as you see it?
The implications, first of all, what he did is we've had people coming across the border and claiming credible fear, and there was a ruling that meant that you had to essentially release those people with bail on bond into the system, and then they never showed up again, essentially, and they were, it was a free ride into the United States with. And then you just duck the courts and you were into the illegal alien kind of infrastructure. Well, Barr said, no, we're not doing that anymore. Under the law, he's perfectly within his rights to say no. And the Immigration Naturalization Services law specifically says that they are not supposed to be released on bail, that they're supposed to be held until they get a hearing. And so that's what the attorney general is doing. He's basically following the law. Imagine that. Quite a concept in our modern judicial world for an attorney general to read the law and say, actually, we're going to do what the law says. So, yeah, he's to be commended. And quite honestly, I always had some concerns about this attorney general when he was appointed. But right now, I think he's doing his job. And I have to say I'm quite pleased and somewhat surprised.
I am too. And again, we'll reserve judgment until we see how he performs in the course of the day today, Rick. But I think so far, so good. And to his credit, specifically, being willing to challenge and even ignore some of the brickbats that are being thrown his way by the left is very much to his credit. Let me turn to another topic, Rick. We've spent a lot of time here talking about 5G, and that is, of course, the network of fifth generation wireless technology that President Trump last week made clear we need to have a secure American version of. This has been a very difficult thing to get done, unfortunately, and the Chinese seem to be poised to eat our lunch with respect to it. I wanted to ask you, because I know you've been following the federal government's harassment of Qualcomm, which has technology that can be very important to our competitiveness in this space. There was a recent development with respect to Qualcomm and one of its, well, past customers and rather dogged critics, namely Apple. They seem to have come to terms, and it may clear the way for 5G technology to be streamlined into Apple products. Can you walk us through all of that?
Sure. It seems rather complicated, but it really isn't. At the end of the Obama administration, the Federal Trade Commission sued Qualcomm largely on behalf of Apple. And they sued Qualcomm. Qualcomm provides the chip, the actual chip that provides the brains for mobile devices, which make them 4G, 3G, 4G, and in the future, 5G. And those chips, what they do is they essentially allow for these machines to talk, for you to go online, for you to be able to do all the things we do with our phones that we take for granted now. That's because of the specific chip that Qualcomm developed. In developing that chip, they said, we'll let you use our chip. We'll sell you access to our chip, but you also have to give us a licensing agreement. You have to pay us money on every phone sold with it. And that means that's about $30 for an iPhone, for the guts of what makes the iPhone work. Well, Apple wanted to cut costs, and so they were attempting to cheap out and not pay their licensing fee. And Qualcomm took them to court and in doing that. But they also had the FTC attack Qualcomm saying, oh, this licensing fee is unfair. And it's a monopoly because you're the only ones who have this chip because you're smart enough to figure out how to invent it. That's the essence of the FTC suit. Apple and Qualcomm settled the lawsuit. Apple is paying Qualcomm's money, and they are, in fact, going to have a deal where they'll be buying Qualcomm chips for at least the next 6 years. And all in all, the system worked. And now what we need is the FTC to recognize the settlement and to drop the case. And it's very simple. But yeah, for once, the system worked. I know you were heavily involved in trying to get the system to work. I know I was. And fortunately, this happened, Frank, in 1 second. The reason it matters is if we don't win the chip battle, the Chinese will have a direct pathway into every one of our mobile phones, another direct pathway, where they can literally be spying on each and every one of us, know our coordinates, and effectively affect every aspect of our of the chip. Every place the chip is, they'll be able to affect it, and we can't allow for Huawei, a Chinese company, to be the dominant chip manufacturer in the world.
Yeah. Rick Manning, you have clarity on these issues as well as an ability to communicate them very effectively, and I appreciate you doing so with us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We have in the house virtually a man much in demand today. His name is Hans von Spakovsky. We call him HVS here at Secure Freedom Radio because it's a less of a mouthful. Hans is, of course, one of the duty experts on legal matters, notably these days as the manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and as a senior legal fellow in the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He also served as counsel to an assistant attorney general for civil rights during the George W. Bush administration, also as a member of the Federal Election Commission. He's a published author of several important books on matters involving voting fraud and about the Justice Department, among other things. So who better to talk to on the, well, immediate eve of the unveiling of the long-awaited Mueller report? Of course, as you all are hearing this program, it will have happened earlier in the day, but we're catching up with Hans, as we did Rick Manning a moment ago, slightly before the rollout begins. Hans, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you for taking a few minutes on this incredibly frenetic day for you. You've already taped a program with Fox News this morning, and thanks for fitting in some time for us today.
Sure. I think this is going to be the busiest day in Washington in quite a while.
I have the feeling, especially for you. Let me ask you about your sort of appraisal, Hans, of the Mueller production, shall we say. What has, in fact, been established so far, and what else do you anticipate will come of the revelations of the actual production now and rollout of the document itself?
Well, I think there's three things to keep in mind here. One, that William Barr, the Attorney General, has already related the conclusion of Bob Mueller, which was there was no evidence of Russian election collusion with the Trump campaign. Second, Barr said there was not evidence that would support an obstruction of justice charge. So I don't think the report, which it's rumored to be upwards of 400 pages, it's not going to change that. There's no way that the Attorney General would somehow mischaracterize the conclusions of the report. Now, will there be, salacious accusations and other things like that in the report? There may be isolated items like that, and folks may try to pull that out and use it against the president. But the bottom line, which I think everyone needs to focus on, is that there was no actual evidence of any criminal wrongdoing. The third thing I think folks should keep in mind is that there is no way that anyone can say that this wasn't a complete, thorough, and comprehensive investigation. Bob Mueller was not in no way limited in what he could do and what he could look at. And he had a huge team of people, in addition to the lawyers that he had. He had an additional 40 FBI agents, intelligence analysts, and others. And I mean, they served 2,800 subpoenas, Frank. That's an enormous investigation. 2,800 subpoenas looking for information and documents. So again, there isn't anybody who could say that they missed something.
Well, I guess what they'll say is that there were certain things that they didn't miss that are still in need of further investigation or constitute grounds for, well, criticism of the president at a minimum, but possibly impeachment. Hans, have you seen anything to this point that would support such efforts going forward?
No, I haven't. And I think that's why I think the Democrats are so desperate now, because what they thought was going to be the way they could pull down this president with this election collusion claim, which has turned out to be a complete hoax, with the obstruction of justice claim. I mean, that's why they spent the morning attacking the attorney general for holding a press conference. I couldn't believe it. They were saying all kinds of nasty things about this very professional, very ethical attorney general for holding a press conference. Frank, you and I have been in this town a long time. You and I both know the Justice Department always holds press conferences when it's making an announcement about a major decision or a major prosecution or anything like that. This is entirely and completely routine, and yet Barr is being attacked just for holding a press conference. I think that's a sign of the desperation of liberals and Democrats.
Well, to be clear, the explanation for this high dudgeon of the Democrats is that he's holding the press conference before the document has been put in their hands, or the hands of the press for that matter. And therefore, as we talked about with Rick Manning, it looks as though he's going to have a chance to get the jump on them in terms of spinning what's in the report. We'll see how much of that he actually does in the event. But this does seem to me to be more, as you say, evidence that this hasn't worked out the way they wanted it to, and they're grasping at straws to try to sully either the administration's handling of the report, or perhaps even some of the conclusions that are in it that are so unsatisfactory to them. Hans, let me pivot for a minute here, because we're also perhaps at the cusp of another investigation, an investigation into actual collusion with the Russians and the so-called counterintelligence investigation that it precipitated, the spying on the Trump campaign and so on. This has been authorized apparently by the Attorney General. What light can you shed on that, the need for it, and where it's likely to lead, do you think?
Well, everyone should remember that this whole thing started as a counterintelligence operation when the Justice Department, the FBI, went to the secret FISA court in Washington. That's the court set up under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And it's the court that we use for counterintelligence operations. If we believe that there's a Russian spy in the U.S. and we want to do electronic surveillance of him, that's the court they go to for that. And that's how this started. Now that we know that this whole claim of Russian collusion was a hoax, I mean, there was just nothing to it. We need to go back and see what was the basis for the FBI going to this court and getting warrants to start this investigation. If they did not have sufficient evidence as required under the statute to justify this, then they abused their law enforcement powers under that law to do what? To do something that's never been done in American history, to launch a counterintelligence operation and then a law enforcement investigation against the presidential campaign of the opposing political party. That has never happened. And if they did not have substantial evidence justifying this, then the people involved need to be, frankly, punished, potentially prosecuted, so that this kind of thing never happens again.
Yeah. Amen. Especially against the backdrop, what I think most of us have taken away from all of this, that there does seem to be a double standard. There does seem to be not one rule of law for all, but special treatment for some of the powerful. And that brings me to the question of the Nunes referrals. Of course, Devin Nunes, the former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, now its ranking member, has apparently made a referral, I think, on 8 different individuals in connection with this so-called Spygate scandal. Can you tell us anything about what that portends in terms of this investigation and that point you've just made about the need for accountability and, if necessary, punishment?
I assume that those referrals will all be wrapped into the investigation that the Attorney General has said is going to be there into the opening up of this investigation, because the referrals, according to Nunes, are going to be for what he believes was lying and leaking of information improperly connected to all of this. So I think that's all going to get wrapped into that investigation. We should mention that something I think a lot of people may forget, that the Inspector General of the Justice Department, Michael Horowitz, has actually also been looking at this matter for quite a while, and not too long ago in his testimony, Barr said he expected to get a report from the Inspector General by the beginning of the summer.
Well, we will all be following this closely, and I know you will as well, Hans von Spakovsky at the Heritage Foundation. We will look forward to taking further counsel with you as the story develops. Let me turn to one last item. Your friend and mine, Christian Adams, has been involved, and I gather you have been at least in a supporting role, in an effort to achieve a degree of, well, justice in an American territory in the far western Pacific known as Guam. This stitches in a number of your favorite topics, including election law and the equal treatment under the law, for that matter. Tell us what's been going on in the case of this former retired Air Force colonel.
Colonel Davis. Yeah, sure. Let me tell you what happened. Davis was stationed on Guam and decided to retire there. And quite a long time ago, in fact, 10 years ago, if you can believe it, during the Obama administration, he tried to register to vote for a plebiscite that the island was going to hold on the future of the island. They would vote on, do they want to continue to be a territory of the U.S., become a state, become an independent country. His vote attempt to register to vote was rejected because he's white. The island government was saying, well, none of the residents of the island can register for this unless they are descendant of the Chamorro tribe, which I guess were the original inhabitants. So everybody else who's moved to the island, lives there, if they're black or Asian, Hispanic or white, you can't register to vote. Now, that is a straight out violation of the Voting Rights Act and the Constitution. And he could not get a single lawyer in Guam to represent him in a voting rights lawsuit against the territorial government. They were all scared to do it. Many of them said it would ruin their business. They'd get in trouble with political leaders and local judges and others. He went to the U.S. Justice Department under Eric Holder, who had no interest whatsoever in this case, even though it was a blatant violation of the Voting Rights Act.
Something they were supposed to be rather big on, as I recall. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation, God bless you. I know you'll keep up the great work, and I hope you come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's time for a regular visit with David Goldman, an extraordinary intellect, well, man of many parts, really, both with respect to high finance, the geostrategic developments of our time, and most especially what's going on in some very important places around the world, including Asia, China specifically, and the Middle East. It's always a pleasure to have him. He's the author of the terrific book, How Civilizations Die, and also a frequent columnist at the Asia Times, writing under the pen name of Spengler. He's the author of a new ebook, a work of fiction, The Quantum Supremacy. David Goldman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Always a delight to have you with us. Welcome.
It's always a privilege, Frank. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's start with China. David, if we might, you've written a piece that talks about the inevitability of the China trade deal because of two overriding considerations. Tell us about those, and if you can, any sort of current crystal ball gazing on the timing of this trade deal and what it might contain.
Well, the question is, who got hurt worse in a trade war?
Our premise last year was that China would be hurt a great deal worse. Their stock market underperformed ours enormously. This year, however, China's economic growth has bounced back faster than most observers expected, and it done entirely by stimulating domestic demand. With the 1.4 billion person domestic market, the Chinese have a lot of tools to replace the business they've lost in trade with internal business. That's exactly what's happened. Their economy is growing at 6.4% as the first quarter, faster than most people expect, and their stock market's been on fire. The Shenzhen 300 index, equivalent of our Dow Jones, is up about 33% this year, twice as much as the S&P 500 and Dow Jones. So it's clear the Chinese have managed to bounce back from what looked like an initial problem. At the same time, world trade has shrunk. Many of our allies who are deeply involved in China-based supply chains, that's Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and also Germany, have seen their economies shrink, go to the verge of recession, or actually in recession. So the damage to the world economy has been much more than to China because of its buffer in the internal market. And in the United States, the biggest disappointment in terms of the economy has been the absence of capital investment. And a lot of that is due to uncertainty about the trade war. So I think it's pretty clear it's in our interest to move past that. And I think that's exactly what the Trump administration will do. He wants to get reelected in 2020. He doesn't want the economy to slow. So reaching a conclusion with the Chinese will be in his best political interest. That's what I expect.
And in terms of the sorts of things that we've heard bruited as having to be inside this deal, notably real protections, enforceable protections against things like technology theft, for example, which is happening at an extraordinary rate. Some estimates run as high as $500 billion per year, which is staggering, needless to say. But also what is a somewhat more ambiguous term, but structural reforms. David Goldman, are those likely to be features of this?
Well, the Chinese are definitely undertaking reforms that many of our big businesses love. For example, they are going to open their financial markets. They want big two-way capital flows. They've already let some major financial institutions open 100% subsidiaries. They've let some of the auto companies buy out their joint venture partners. There's a report that Volkswagen, biggest nameplate in China, is going to buy out its joint venture partners. So in a number of areas, they definitely will open up. And to some extent, this is a gigantic bribe to the corporate sector in the United States. Go make money in China, help them make their capital markets more efficient, help prepare for the RMB to become a global reserve currency by having the backing of more efficient and transparent markets, and let JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs and BlackRock make a lot of money there. So I think they will open it, but I'm not sure it's necessarily entirely in our interest.
David, speaking of entirely in our interest and how this is ultimately going to sort out, I hear you on the point that the Chinese have, by infusing immense amounts of cash into sort of a stimulus for their economy, managed to attenuate, shall we say, some of the downside risks to them of this trade war. What costs are associated with doing that, other than the obvious, you know, cost in adding to their debt? But is that likely to prove a serious problem to them, especially given all of the other expenses that they're incurring, notably with their Belt and Road Initiative investments around the world?
Well, not soon enough to suit me. That's a very long-term kind of problem. China's debt to GDP ratio is about the same as ours. It looks very different in terms of composition, because a lot of what we would consider government spending is counted as corporate debt there, because it's on the books of state-owned companies, but it's really government debt. The real question, which is hard to measure, is to what extent are the 6,000 miles of highway they're building every year, to what extent are the thousands of miles of high-speed train adding to productivity? They're putting a lot of infrastructure in. Their infrastructure is really spectacularly good. It's daunting to go to China and see how much better they are in many respects than the U.S. Will that turn out to be white elephants? I think there'll be many cases where they are, but I don't see that being a problem for them within the strategic horizon that I'm concerned about. It won't hurt them. If it will hurt them, won't hurt them fast enough.
We will be watching how fast it hurts them and hoping for the best, I guess. David Goldman, with your considerable help, notably at Asia Times. Let me ask you about one other thing, David. You've written recently about the need to repurpose NATO or it will die. This is a very important topic, it seems to me, for a lot of reasons, not least of which is the role being played at the moment by a country I know you follow with great care, namely Turkey. There's a serious altercation underway between the United States and other NATO members, I think, and the Turks over the deployment imminently of the S-400 surface-to-air missile system. And I wonder, at what point does the fact that Turkey is an ally no more have to translate into a change in the NATO relationship with Turkey?
Well, Frank, that the ally no more, of course, is the title of a book that your center published, and I had the honor to contribute a chapter to. Buying the top-of-the-line Russian air defense system, the S-400, should be completely incompatible with NATO membership. There are some legal difficulties. There isn't a transparent procedure for expelling a country from NATO, but whatever it is, we should figure it out. There was a brilliant paper written by a professor at University of Pennsylvania named Walter McDougall for the Law and Liberty site saying, by diluting NATO, by expanding it to include every country in the world, we basically destroyed its mission because we can't defend everybody. If everybody's there, nobody's really being defended. So he said NATO is finished. My argument was that American technological leadership in the Reagan years bound everybody to us because we were the only game in town, certainly the hottest game in town. We crushed the Russians by leapfrogging them with dual-use technologies. And if we repurpose NATO and reestablish American technological dominance, everyone in the world, Germans, French, British, and a whole lot of them, are going to want to line up behind us because they will need to, both for military and economic reasons. It's really the Clinton policy of diluting NATO by making it into a social club, doing social work and nation building that ruined the organization.
Well, this is a really important topic. I don't think the problem is whether there's a transparent mechanism for removing the Turks. I'm fearful that there's no mechanism at all for expelling a nation from NATO simply because it has ceased to be, in fact, a real partner in the common defense. This is a challenge we will be vexed by for a while, I'm afraid, but I think we have to grab this bull by the horns, as they say. David, we have to, unfortunately, grab the fact that we are out of time as well. I appreciate so much yours today, as always, and the fact that you make such valuable contributions to the intelligence briefing that we try to provide here at Secure Freedom Radio in this war for the free world. Thank you for doing so today. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.